From our studios in downtown Washington, D.C., this is D.C. Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. The show today is about evidence-based parole and probation, evidence-based reentry from prison. And as always, we'd like to thank you for listening to the show. We are amazed as to all the contacts you're giving us, the emails, Twitter messages, and the comments in terms of D.C. Public Safety through the comments section. You can always contact me at Leonard, L-E-O-N-A-R-D dot Sipes, S-I-P-E-S. At csosa.gov or Twitter me at Twitter/LenSipes. Our guest today is Neil Goodloe. Neil is a trainer and consultant for North Point Institute for Public Management. But the important thing is that Neil was with the Commonwealth of Virginia. He was chief probation officer at the end of his career in the Charlottesville, Virginia area. And I'm going to give you a couple of contact points for Neil before we begin the program. His website is www.northpointeinc.com, and you can reach Neil via email at ngoodloe@npipm.com. I'll be repeating those throughout the show. Neil Goodloe, welcome to DC Public Safety.
Good morning, Len, and thank you for having me on the show.
I heard Neil, ladies and gentlemen, at a conference, and although I was dealing with media, multiple media at the time, I didn't have the opportunity to listen to everything that Neil was saying. But when I was in the room, Neil, you know, spoke passionately about this whole concept of evidence-based parole and probation, evidence-based reentry. And, you know, those of us in the criminal justice system, we talk about evidence-based issues a lot, and as to whether or not there really is a strong evidence base for community corrections, for parole and probation, for offender reentry. Neil spoke passionately. He was on the mark. He was on the point. He told lots of stories about his time with the Commonwealth of Virginia as the chief probation officer in Charlottesville, Virginia, the chances that he had to take and the opportunities that he created for this whole concept of evidence-based community corrections. So Neil Goodloe, who's now a trainer and consultant with North Point Institute, again, welcome back to DC Public Safety. Neil, give me a sense as to what evidence base really means.
Well, really, it means practices that are based at least in part on research and science and the accumulated wealth of information over the past two, some would argue even three decades, into what actually works in a correctional setting to improve not only short-term processes, but long-term outcomes.
But that a lot of us in the system struggle with the concept of evidence-based. Now, I'm completely sold. I think evidence-based procedures are absolutely wonderful, and I think you were able to score some major coups down there in the Charlottesville, Virginia area. But we struggle with evidence-based. You know, there's a consensus of people that I've talked to who say that, you know, Leonard, when it comes to drug treatment, there seems to be almost an exact science of the kind of drug treatment, of the kind of analysis, of the kind of individualization that you take, the modality, how long the individual should be there, what sort of follow-up there should be. There's a lot of precision in terms of drug treatment. But when it comes to the other parts of what it is that we do, whether it's supervising offenders, how big the caseload should be, how many contacts should you have with the individual, what kind of individual should get the most supervision. Those are all concepts that are still up in the air. There's no solid evidence. They believe that there's a limited amount of solid evidence to tell us, to guide us, to indicate to us what we should be doing regarding parole and probation.
Well, I would beg to differ. I think that if you read the literature, as it has accumulated by way of a process called meta-analysis, which is roughly translated to the study of studies, there has been a considerable accumulation of evidence over the last couple decades that there are specific things that work. Those specific things are interwoven in a practice, and I think one of the difficulties that people have in applying evidence-based practices in real time in real correctional situations is that they try to implement different pieces of this puzzle without seeing the entire structure of an evidence-based practice all woven together with a common thread.
And that's the point, though. That's the point that the you know, all of us believe in this stuff. I mean, we're I'm talking to you, you're talking to me, the people that I talk to, we all believe that this is exactly the way that we should go. But, you know, there is the Washington State Public Policy Institute, and thank God for them, that provides a list of research. It's a state agency that provides a list of research of 554 comparison group evaluations of adult corrections, juvenile corrections, and prevention programs. And they, in a very recent document, although it's they've said the same thing before, you know, do give, you know, what programs do give a sense, or not a sense, but give a precise list as to what programs work and what programs do not work. So we have that, but beyond Washington State Institute for Public Policy, that all that accumulation of evidence doesn't seem to reside in one particular place.
Well, and I think that was particularly my problem when I embraced these concepts back originally in around 2004, 2005. There was at the time no real roadmap as to how to implement the what works literature.
Mm-hmm.
And so myself and my colleagues in Virginia, there were actually five pilot sites for the implementation of an evidence-based practice in Virginia Community Corrections. And we struggled early on with just the idea of how do we operationalize these lessons that have been learned through meta-analysis, and how do we apply these to our particular circumstance where we are, knowing that each one of us were facing a different set of challenges. And so one of the things we had to come to grips with from the very beginning is that you start where you are, not where you want to be or not where somebody else is. You start where you are, and you start with what you have, which at this point is a fairly stressed system that is struggling to find resources to address needs. And the resources that we do have are often devoted to risk control efforts, which are important, but fewer resources are devoted to risk reduction, which I would argue keeps us safer 5 years from now.
I think most criminologists would state that the research is somewhat clear that there has to be a combination of supervising offenders and at the same time assisting offenders. And, you know, from time to time, I'll do shows and people will disagree. They will say that, you know, Leonard, your job as a law enforcement agency is to make sure that offenders are doing what it is they're supposed to be doing. And my counter is that in terms of mental health, who would deny an individual coming out of the prison system who was obviously mentally ill, who would deny that person mental health assistance? And what are the odds of that person reoffending, costing the state millions of dollars in the long run in terms of a crime, in terms of an investigation, in terms of a prosecution, and in terms of a reincarceration? You know, that if he doesn't get the mental health treatment, it seems inevitable that he's going to move down that path. So that's the example that I use, that mental health treatment is part of it, but it's also other things such as educational programs, such as assisting people in terms of their finding jobs. I mean, the list goes on.
Well, it does. And ultimately, behind all of the reasoning for an evidence-based practice is a truth that had escaped me for years as a probation officer. I had attempted to change people from the outside in for years. And obviously that can become a very frustrating experience for a practitioner when you see the same people who you fixed come back for second and third and fourth helpings of correctional resources.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, it became abundantly clear to me that there is this careful balancing act between risk control and risk reduction, and that embedded in that strategy are elements of risk control, which we will never be able to divorce ourselves from. They're part of the job of a probation officer. They're part of the job of folks in institutions to run safe and orderly prisons. These are very important, but they're incomplete. And they are incomplete because they do not address the primary factor that weighs into whether somebody actually changes their behavior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is that change is an intrinsic issue. It happens inside someone, lasting change anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And change is achieved when an individual internally decides that that their thinking and their behavior is not getting them what they want.
Go back to the days when you started this concept, when you became the chief probation officer for the Charlottesville, Virginia metropolitan area. I think it's four or five counties surrounding Charlottesville. Go back to those days. You've seen the constant flow of people coming in and out of the office. Every parole and probation agent in the country sees that constant flow of people coming in and out of the office. And at what point did you sit down and say, you know, there's got to be a better way of doing this?
I think it's probably when I started seeing children of former probationers coming in, and then at some point seeing grandchildren of former probationers coming in, realizing that not only was there not a significant change process taking place in the lives of the people I worked with 20 years ago, but that there was a ripple effect, and that the dysfunctional elements in their lives had been passed down from generation to generation. And I just got really tired of seeing the same people time and time again and then seeing their offspring.
That's a powerful point, by the way, a frightening point and a powerful point. But please go ahead.
So the idea originally occurred to a couple of folks in Virginia independently. It was very interesting how it evolved. I went off to Sam Houston State University right mm-hmm. after I was appointed the chief for new executive training.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the first times that I had really been exposed to evidence-based philosophies of management.
Mm-hmm.
And it just started planting a seed in my mind. And then a very good friend of mine and colleague from Charlottesville named Pat Smith, who ran our local probation office, invited me to a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And at that meeting, we were addressed by several members from the National Institute of Corrections, who presented us with essentially, an hour's worth of the evidence, which was extremely compelling. And I left that meeting with sufficient doubt in my mind as to the efficacy of what I had been doing personally in my practice for, well, really 20 years.
So the whole idea is that the NIC, the National Institute of Corrections, part of the U.S. Department of Justice, provides you with an overview of evidence-based practices. And so, needless to say, that you went back to your superiors and you went back to the funding sources, and everybody quickly agreed, the staff quickly fell in line, and you were able to, within a couple months, start this process of introducing evidence-based procedures, correct?
Well, that sounds a whole lot easier than it actually was. Sounds a little like a fairy tale. If it were that easy, everybody would have already fully implemented evidence-based practices by now. But it's not. It's a process. I am convinced more than ever that it is a process that is attitudinal. It involves people. And I think that's one of the things about the research itself that is lacking, is that human dimension.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy in an ivory tower environment for an academic to say, do this because this works. But it's another thing entirely to actually implement better assessment and better interpretation of that assessment and better engagement with an offender and better case planning that comes out of that engagement and better better interventions that are the product of that plan.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot harder to do that in real time with real people who are already up to their necks in work, and are and have really many of them who have been in corrections for a long time have been battling the workflow for years. As you know, it's not surprising that they would be a little worn out and tired given the magnitude of the increases in the correctional population from year to year.
It's one of the hardest jobs in the world. I've done pieces of it throughout my career, and it was exhausting every time. I'm going to reintroduce Neil Goodloe, everybody. He's a trainer and consultant for North Point Institute for Public Management. He was with the Commonwealth of Virginia, the chief probation officer for Charlottesville, Virginia, and the surrounding area counties. I'm going to give the website. He currently works, again, for North Point Institute. The web address for North Point Institute is www.northpointinc.com, or you can reach him directly at npipm.com. Neil, let's pick it back up. We have another 15 minutes left. So you go back to staff, and staff understandably says, look, we're up to our eyebrows in offenders as it is. We're, you know, running, we're working late, we're working weekends. You know, please, you're asking us to take on a whole brand new batch of duties.
Yes.
And so I'm not quite sure that they're going to go skipping and dancing into the night of people who consider themselves to be awesomely overworked to take on yet another huge amount of work.
I wouldn't describe them to be universally enthusiastic, although I will say that there were considerable numbers of my staff that understood that an emphasis solely or largely on risk control was not making us safer in the long term.
And I think they would come to that, consensus. And if they cared at all about not just having a job, if they went beyond that to the larger public safety issues, I would imagine that eventually they would support it. But at the beginning, I mean, this sounds frightening. You're now going to do what? You're not going to help them find employment. You're not going to help them with their mental health issues. You're now going to help them find a place to stay. You're now going to help get them involved in drug treatment. You're now going to help them in terms of their family issues. And you're going to bring a new attitude towards it that, yeah, you're still going to supervise the dickens out of them, but at the same time, you're going to try to help them get the services they need. Now, is that the gist of it?
Well, that and more. And I think the real dividing line between business as usual and an evidence-based approach is that two very basic things. We assess. And when we assess, we understand who is at high risk to recidivate.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done that before, and there's some tools to do that, but we really didn't understand well enough the causal factors that were fueling that risk.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it is getting smarter about what to attack, which needs are most linked to future criminal activity. And if we were to reduce the strength of those crime-producing or criminogenic needs over time, that we could actually reduce recidivism in the community.
Right, and keep the community safer.
So some of it is simply understanding the not just needs in isolation, but needs is how they relate to other needs, and how there are some needs that are very long standing and very well entrenched. There are other needs that are very transient and more easily overcome.
Why is the offender doing what they're doing? That's the bottom line, correct?
Essentially, yes.
Okay.
But if it were that easy, we'd be done already.
Well,
the real trick is in getting folks to actually engage the offender in a conversation about those needs,
mm-hmm.
and to help create some type of motivational leverage to drive this person to help them come off of their pre-contemplative view of change and to actually get them to embrace the concept that they need to change.
Well, you know, it's funny because this gets to the heart and soul of the conversation. There's a lot of people who deal with offenders who essentially state that they do want to change, but they find themselves in circumstances where they don't know how to change. Now, that creates a big excuse for bad behavior or for illegal behavior, and I will get emails regarding that. But in essence, if the person has this anger problem that they've had because they were abused or abandoned by the parents or one parent in the household, and if he grows up angry and if he grows up with that chip on his shoulder, that's a lifelong sort of thing that is not easily overcome.
And it's not only not easily overcome, it also bleeds out into virtually every other segment of their life.
Right.
So it tends to exacerbate any other dysfunctional elements this person might have.
Right. So helping that person come to grips with why he's got a chip on his shoulder the size of Montana becomes important. And once that recognition takes place, getting them in the proper mental health or counseling services to help them deal with it. Am I on track or am I off track?
No, I think you're right on the money. In fact, if you look at the Washington State meta-analysis, you see the words cognitive behavioral time and time again under the category of things that work and things that provide a fairly sizable bang for the buck.
Mm-hmm.
What the science is telling us and what actual practice is confirming is that the most effective forms of treatment for many of these dysfunctional elements involve their thinking. Because thinking is no more than an action that hasn't taken place yet. So if we can address the thinking that underlies behavior and actually teach skills to address dysfunctional thinking as it happens, there are reductions in recidivism that occur that are pretty eye-popping.
So instead of simply lashing out immediately over a provocation, the person thinks about how he's going to respond to that provocation, where in the past it would have been a violent response almost instantaneously, maybe something that he doesn't quite even understand himself. Now it's a process of thinking through his behavior, and that can be done?
It's essentially social learning in action.
Okay.
And it involves practice. It involves practice in a safe setting. And it involves repeated practice until new skills become fairly well entrenched and can be used in a very stressful situation, as you just described.
But when we're doing all of this, it's just not anger management, which is what we call it here at the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency. It's just not drug treatment. It's just not mental health treatment. It's just not employment. Or it's just not housing. It's all of that put together in terms of an integrated whole. That's when it gets really complicated.
And it really does, especially when we understand that we achieve the greatest reductions in recidivism by accentuating the use of our resources and most of our time and most of our attention and energy on that highest risk population.
And the research does seem, as long as we're talking about evidence base, that the research does seem to suggest, not with a lot of precision, but basically suggests that we get the biggest bang for our buck by focusing on the high-risk population and in some cases doing very little / nothing with a low-risk population. Am I correct in that?
Well, in fact, there is a sizable body of research that would suggest that overdosing low-risk offenders with supervision is actually harmful and raises their risk profile unintentionally.
Okay, but does that apply to providing services as well? Because, you know, if a judge orders drug treatment for a person with a marginal history of substance abuse, those guidelines of the court are enforceable. And if that person doesn't go the drug treatment, then he could be violated and returned to prison.
Yes.
So the question becomes, does that apply to lower risk, to social, do looking at the social needs of an offender, of a low-risk offender, is that part of this thought, or is it just being careful in terms of not to over-supervise a low-risk offender? I hope I'm making sense.
Sure. Low-risk offenders actually do have needs, and they may have fairly sizable needs, but those needs are not directly related to any risk of recidivism. My concern about tossing low-risk and high-risk folks into the same treatment settings, though, is that social learning is going on in the training setting. And if you have two individuals, say Ward Cleaver on the low end and Charles Manson on the high end, the good news is that, that by virtue of that interaction, Charlie gets a little bit more pro-social. But in the process, Ward picks up a whole lot of antisocial, very toxic beliefs and attitudes and values from Charlie.
Okay.
So there are significant indications that we can lower recidivism generally in our in the communities by finding ways to keep low risk and high risk folks away from each other.
All right, Neil, we got 4 minutes left. Summarize, if you would. I mean, give me a quick list of what the evidence does say in terms of reentry, of offender reentry, in terms of parole and probation supervision. Give me the five most important lessons from the research.
Wow. In 4 minutes? Okay, here goes. First of all, we need to understand that the criminal justice system is a process. It's not seven or eight different siloed organizations all working independently. In order to maximize risk reduction efforts, we need to be able to break down a lot of the barriers that have existed historically between pretrial and the judiciary.
Okay. So everybody has to work together.
Everybody has to work together and start speaking a common language about what we're trying to do.
Okay.
So that we're not reinventing the wheel at every single step when a person goes from a local jail to a state prison and then on to parole or on to probation. All part of a plan that is very carefully orchestrated, very carefully staged and sequenced.
Understood. What's the next
point? So that one intervention is building on what's been done before.
Understood. Next point.
All right. So there's one. Another thing is I think we have overvalued how good we are at exercising human judgment as a risk indicator.
What does that mean?
What that means is that we, in an average workday, we make hundreds of decisions that are either instantaneous or near so. And we use our gut to do that. Well, unfortunately, the research is showing pretty clearly that our gut is not a whole lot better than flipping a coin when it comes to actually predicting future criminality.
Okay,
We need to be able to rely on actuarial assessment instruments to be able to be comfortable with what they're telling us, and then to be able to very carefully blend what we're seeing and our judgment and our experience and take that risk tool and understand what it's telling us and be able to make decisions that are better informed.
Okay.
When we use the science.
So we have all worked together. We need to assess the offender.
Next thing we need to do is be able to interpret what that assessment is telling us, be able to connect the dots of causation from the time this person was born until they're sitting across from you in the office, to be able to understand in some logical, linear way how their crime-producing issues developed, how strong they are, and what we can do together,
right,
the officer and the offender, to enter into some type of behavioral contract to address those issues.
Okay, so we map out a plan.
You map out a plan, but that plan can't be just the probation officer's plan.
Oh, absolutely.
The plan has to be a plan that is mutually developed. Otherwise, it's going to end up in the trash can in the lobby as the offender leaves.
Understood.
They're just not going to have any buy-in.
I have a quick question, and we're almost out of time, but where are the resources coming from to do all these services?
Well, interestingly enough, there are initiatives out of Washington. The Second Chance Act contains millions of dollars to help us better understand how the reentry process works, what we can do to maximize the chances of somebody staying out of prison once they've been released. And so there is money in the pipeline and available by way of grant application to go after some of this money. There are also I think there's an understanding in many states around the country now that we need to take the dollars that we do have already and be able to maximize their use so that, you know, as stewards of the taxpayers' money, we are providing the highest value for each of those dollars that we can.
Neil, you've got the final word. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been DC Public Safety. Our guest today has been Neil Goodloe. Neil is a trainer and consultant with North Point Institute for Public Management. He was the chief of probation for the Commonwealth of Virginia in the Charlottesville metropolitan area of Virginia, the four or five counties surrounding. You can, the website for North Point is www.northpointwithanEinc.com. Neil's direct email is ngoodloe@npipm.com. Neil, I'm just going to quickly summarize. I think what you're saying is that we all need to work together. There needs to be a thorough assessment of the offender. We need to map out a plan. We need to know what the evidence has to say. What the recommendations are in terms of best practices, and we need to put it together in terms of a consensual call. Do I have it or do I not have it?
All that plus protecting our people and not burning them out in the process.
Lord.
Because the people are the most expensive and most important resource that we bring to bear in this problem. And if we don't solve that human element, we'll just end up in a continual turnover cycle that will not get us where we need to go.
Completely agreed. Ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank you for listening, and you can reach me, Leonard, LEONARD.Sipes, SIPES, or you can follow me at Twitter/LenSipes, or you can comment on DC Public Safety, either the television shows, the radio shows, the transcripts, or the blog. Please have yourselves a very, very pleasant day.